It was a great, memorable day when the flocks of passenger pigeons came to our farm. Of all God's feathered people that sailed the Wisconsin sky, no other bird seemed to us so wonderful. The beautiful wanderers flew like the winds in flocks of millions, finding their food in fields and forests thousands of miles apart. How wonderful the distances they flew in a day, in a year, in a lifetime. Those are the comments of 19th century conservationist John Muir about the passenger pigeon, a species destined for extinction. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
...2014 marks the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, at one point the most abundant bird in North America and possibly the world. At one point there were so many passenger pigeons that they darkened the sky for days. But in 1914, a passenger pigeon named Martha, the last of her species, died at the Cincinnati Zoo. What caused the passenger pigeons to go extinct? Why should we care? And what are the lessons from this story? Joining us is Stanley Temple, Beers Baskin Professor Emeritus in Conservation from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
It's good to be here again.
When you look at the story of the passenger pigeon and that word billions comes into play, it's hard to imagine how even a concerted effort would have managed to make them all extinct in the course of maybe 100 years of trying?
Well, it happened in less than 100 years. It was really during about a 50-year period in the second half of the 19th century. The estimates of how many pigeons there were, of course, are rough estimates. No one really counted them, but 3 to 5 billion is the sort of accepted figure.
And we think of them as an American bird. Is that accurate?
It's completely a North American species found almost entirely in the eastern half of North America, especially in the deciduous forest region.
And can you describe them and how they differ from other kinds of pigeons that we might think about?
Sure. Well, they are pigeons, so they are somewhat similar to their relatives. Superficially, they look like a big mourning dove. They're about 1.5 times the size of the common mourning dove. They are not closely related to the pigeon of barns and city parks. Turns out their closest relative is actually a species in the western U.S. called the band-tailed pigeon. But the passenger pigeon was unique. Genetically, it was unique evolutionarily and had some, not only its great abundance, but it had some other unique aspects of its ecology and life history that allowed it to achieve those spectacular numbers. And you mentioned, Norman, that, you know, billions are sort of hard to get your head around. And it was estimated by the world's authority on the passenger pigeon, a Wisconsinite named Bill Shorger, who literally wrote the book on the passenger pigeon, that at the start of the 19th century, probably one in every four birds in North America was a passenger pigeon.
Wow, that's pretty staggering.
And if you put all those passenger pigeons beak to tail and line them up in a row, they would circle the earth at the equator 23 times.
Oh, gosh.
So it gives you an idea of, you know, just the magnitude that we're talking about, that they literally could darken the skies for days as they flew past in these enormous flocks.
Well, I remember reading one account, and I don't remember who the author was, of when these passenger pigeons would come to roost in trees, farmers coming and knocking them out of the trees and having their pigs just feed on them right on the spot. I mean, it was what shall we say, large scale and so immediate. But even that, it's hard to imagine, would have put such a dent in billions of passenger pigeons.
Well, when you look at the story of the passenger pigeon, the things that were happening in the second half of the 19th century sort of came together in a perfect storm. During that period, market hunting was a very common profession in the United States. We had no laws and regulations and policies about harvesting wildlife. It was pretty much open access, Wild West, frontier, everything was possible. And certainly with a species that presented such apparent abundance, and that was tasty. Uh-huh. Markets for passenger pigeons developed pretty quickly.
Why was it called passenger pigeon, and how is that related to the carrier pigeon, homing pigeons?
Well, the homing pigeon, carrier pigeon, those are all domestic pigeons that are trained to carry messages or to fly in races to see who can get back to their home loft quickest. But the passenger pigeon, the name comes from the French, a bird of passage. And its scientific name actually means the wandering migrant. And part of their ecology and life history in the eastern deciduous forest depended not only on these huge numbers, but depended on being nomadic, wandering extensively, not following the same routes every year the way many birds do, not nesting or roosting in the same place, but wandering in search of their primary food, which was mast. Mast are the nuts of forest trees, especially the ones that periodically produce a real abundance of nuts. Oak and beech were the two trees that were basically the mainstays for passenger pigeons. And here in Wisconsin, of course, we have lots of oaks, and anyone who has oaks in their neighborhood will know that they don't produce acorns every year. But when they do produce them, it's a real bounty of acorns. And the wanderings of these passenger pigeons was basically wandering around the eastern deciduous forest looking for the spots in which one of these periodic abundances of mast was occurring so that they could basically feed in these large flocks, which, of course, required a lot of food.
I gather the largest, roosting of passenger pigeons on record took place in Wisconsin?
That's right. The largest nesting in this case. So during the nesting season was the one time of the year that passenger pigeons had to stand still. They were tied to their nest for about a month. And that was the period of the year in which the market hunters, these commercial hunters, and there were literally thousands of them during the 19th century, that was when they could really cash in on the pigeons. For the rest of the year, they had to follow them, and that, you know, presented some difficulties keeping up with the birds. But two things happened in the mid-19th century that made these market hunters just deadly efficient at their job. It's the expansion of the telegraph system and the expansion of the railroad. The telegraph system allowed the market hunters to track the birds so that they knew exactly where they were at any moment during the year. And all of these thousands of pigeoners, as they were called, it's actually a profession that shows up on the U.S. Census records, they would essentially follow the pigeons 365 days a year, killing them continuously.
Now, explain that with the telegraph service. You mean they're telegraphing each other?
The telegraph system, right. The word would go out, and the pigeoners would find out, and essentially all of the pigeoners in the eastern U.S. would converge on the spot where the pigeons were nesting. So in 1871, the largest nesting of passenger pigeons ever recorded occurred in central Wisconsin. It covered about 850 square miles with
wow.
dozens of pigeon nests in every tree. It's almost impossible to imagine.
So this is an area almost 30 miles square.
Yeah.
With nothing but passenger pigeons
in every
covering
tree.
The whole thing. Now, these pigeon hunters, were they popping off one pigeon with one bullet, or was there some more effective way that they had?
Well, they became very efficient at it, and they could trap the birds thousands at a time in nets. They certainly shot them, and with that kind of density of birds, literally a shotgun blast pointed in the air would bring dozens of pigeons down. They lit fires under the nesting birds to cause the squabs to fall out of the nest and for the adults to choke on the smoke. They knocked them out of the trees with long poles. It was horrific, the descriptions. Bill Shorger does a, unfortunately, a very accurate job of depicting what happened in 1871. And it was just a massacre. So what happened as a result of these pigeoners being able to converge on these nestings is that, you know, they could be there and they could harvest the birds, massacre the birds, really, for a month nonstop. and the railroad system allow them to pack the plucked and gutted birds in ice and ship them off literally by the millions to the growing urban areas, especially in the Midwest, where there was a ready market for these pigeons.
So do we see a lot of recipe books coming out in the 1870s?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. My wife is a native of Madison, her family is, and in her family's collection of artifacts was a recipe book that her great-great-grandmother had written about the turn of the last century. And my wife Jane was reading this book, and all of a sudden there was a whoop out of the living room, and she said, "Oh my gosh, here's a recipe for potted passenger pigeon." With the footnote, I think it was 1902 when the book was written, but in 1902 the footnote was, they're getting hard to come by these days. Well, by 1902 they were essentially gone. But the numbers of birds that made it to market was just staggering. They packed them 300 to a barrel. And during that 1871 nesting, they literally chartered entire trains that did nothing but haul barrels of 300 birds per barrel to Chicago and Milwaukee and Minneapolis. And when you look at you know, what that means, 2,000 barrels of passenger pigeons, that's 600,000 yes. birds on one train. And the 2,000 barrels, the story behind that is that the train that was carrying those 2,000 barrels ran into mechanical problems and was delayed long enough that the barrels of ice started to melt. And the story is that they dumped 600,000 dead pigeons into the Wisconsin River.
Lovely. And so these birds were... you say they were gutted, but not plucked.
They were plucked and gutted, yeah.
Oh, they were plucked and gutted, so and it was sent really off ready to serve.
Ready to be served, right.
You know, you include in your materials a quote also from John James Audubon going back farther, going to 1831. And it's interesting in his description that he sees them not just in terms of, you know, here's a nice bird, but also in terms of the dung, you know, the bird droppings. He writes, "I observed the pigeons flying from northeast to southwest in greater numbers than I thought I had ever seen them before. The air was literally filled with pigeons. The light of noonday was obscured as by an eclipse. The dung fell in spots, not unlike melting flakes of snow, and the combined buzz of wings had a tendency to lull my senses to repose." It must have been overwhelming, you know, to see the sky darkened by the birds. Do you think in some ways that just the sheer abundance led to them being seen as pests, as vermin, as nuisances that needed to be wiped out?
You know, I think, Emily, probably more likely that huge abundance lulled people into a sense that passenger pigeons were an inexhaustible resource. Mm-hmm. They were used to seeing them in these vast numbers. And it was almost at the time when we really didn't have ecology or conservation to sort of understand how you could reduce that great abundance to zero in a short period of time. And there were two components to why we were able to do it so quickly. The first, obviously, was the massacre of the birds, hundreds of millions of birds killed every nesting season. But the second part of it was that so much activity was focused on these nesting colonies that the birds raised virtually no young. The disturbance was that great. The parents were shot. The squabs starved to death or were knocked from the nest. And I guess you really don't even need ecology or conservation to tell you if you're massacring the species and preventing them from reproducing, extinction becomes a mathematical certainty. There's no question that it is going to happen.
And habitat going down pretty fast, too, we assume.
Well, that's true. During this period, the eastern deciduous forest was reduced in size. And although that probably would never have caused the passenger pigeon to go extinct, given that they were wanderers looking for these local abundances of mast, if you reduced the area of forest, you reduced the opportunities for them. You reduced the places where they could find them.
It makes them easier to find.
And it makes them easier to find, right. The places where they could nest in abundance became fewer and fewer. And Wisconsin and Michigan were the last places, really, where there were these enormous nestings.
Was there some other reason to shoot them besides food? I mean, was a lot of it just sort of for sport? Or was there, in other words, there something about these particular birds other than their taste that was leading to their being targeted?
Well, in the Midwest, not in the breeding season, but during the migration period when the birds were on the move, they had started to make themselves an agricultural pest. Remember, these are birds that are sort of focused on finding locally abundant patches of food. And a wheat field in Iowa in the fall, ready for harvest, looks pretty good. And if you're a wheat farmer in Iowa in 1870 and suddenly millions of passenger pigeons descend on your field, it is something of a disaster. And there were reports starting to come in that the farmers were upset about the devastation that they would cause on the crops. So, yes, I mean, there was certainly a possibility that we would have persecuted them as pests if we hadn't wiped them out. But I should add that it wasn't just killing them for the market that the pigeoners did throughout the year, especially when the birds were moving and they couldn't kill them in large numbers. They trapped them live.
Why?
And they trapped them live because, boy, if it was back in the 1800s, if you wanted to sharpen your shotgun skills, you didn't shoot at clay pigeons. You shot at passenger pigeons.
Oh.
So they were sold live to sporting groups, and basically they were shot. And
still done today, not with passenger pigeons,
not with
but
passenger
with others.
Pigeons, but with other pigeons.
Take
right?
it up to the end of a ramp, release it, and your paying customer shoots it out of the sky.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, that from this period when they were trapping them for basically target practice, the pigeon idea, the clay pigeon, you know, replacing the passenger pigeon, came into our lexicon. But the other interesting thing is that when they trapped the birds in these huge nets, they would have lure birds that sat on a little contraption where they would flap their wings and it would lure the wild pigeons in. And in the pigeoner's parlance, those were called stool pigeons.
Uh-huh.
And we still use that term today for someone who betrays their comrades. It's really kind of amazing how many words have entered, you know, into our vocabulary from the pigeon era. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of place names in the eastern U.S. that are named Pigeon Hill, Pigeon Falls, Pigeon River, Pigeon Lake, go on and on and on. And although the people living there today might not realize the pigeons that their town or landmark was named for, these were passenger pigeons. And when you look at the extent of all of these places that were named after pigeons, you start to realize that during these wanderings, the pigeons at one time or another visited just about every place in the eastern U.S. Not every year, but at one point or another, they would visit the place. So just about everyone in the eastern U.S. knew about pigeons, sort of expected them to return in abundance. But when they didn't in the late 19th century, it was pretty easy for local people to say, oh, well, you know, they've gone somewhere else. And as the extinction approached and became clear that the birds were really just gone everywhere, there were some absolutely fantastical sort of stories made up about why the pigeons had gone away.
Other than the fact that people were, like, blasting them and trapping them?
Well, it was sort of denial, I think. Yeah, these stories were basically designed to minimize our responsibility for it.
You mean like supernatural elements?
Well, it comes pretty close. No greater figure than Henry Ford speculated very publicly that he was certain that all the pigeons had drowned in the Pacific Ocean trying to fly to Japan.
And why?
Uh-huh. I said, fantastical story. But there were many others that they had flown somewhere else and, you know, not to worry. They're somewhere.
So meanwhile, we have Martha in the zoo there in Cincinnati?
Well, Martha's an interesting story. It turns out Martha's a badger. She was born in Wisconsin. The records aren't perfectly clear whether she was born in captivity or whether she was taken from the wild as a squab, but she was initially the possession of an aviculturist in Milwaukee who was interested in passenger pigeons and had a small flock and figured out how to breed them. not for captive breeding for conservation purposes. It was just his hobby. And eventually he sort of got tired of doing this and passed his flock on to another aviculturist in Chicago who apparently wasn't quite as skillful, and the birds kind of dwindled under his care. And eventually he unloaded them on to the Cincinnati Zoo. And the handful of birds that the Cincinnati Zoo acquired over the years dwindled down to one, Martha. And Martha is one of those unusual circumstances where we know to the hour when the species went extinct. She wasn't looking well at noon, and at 1 o'clock she was dead in her cage on September 1st, 1914.
Longevity in the wild of a passenger pigeon?
Like most pigeons, and indeed these ones, these handful of birds that were in captivity, they live to a reasonably good age, 20 to 30 years.
Oh, that long?
Yeah. So Martha herself was 28 years old.
So we really did have, we collectively had a chance to bring that passenger pigeon flock into, back into some considerable size. Had several years at least in which to do that, but for various reasons, it just didn't happen.
It didn't. Largely, you know, we didn't have our conservation ethic of the 20th century, which, by the way, the loss of the passenger pigeon was in no small part the catalyst that launched the 20th century conservation movement. People were shocked.
Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. The buffalo, the American bison, was down to how many? I mean, you could count them probably on a few hands. And you would think that would have been the catalyst, even though there was a government eradication program at one point. But you would think that would be much more of a catalyst than a pigeon in terms of sparking a conservation movement.
Well, you have to realize, it wasn't just passenger pigeons and bison that were hunted. During that commercial market hunting period, there were literally dozens and dozens of very desirable species that were either pushed to extinction or pushed very close to extinction. I think the reason the passenger pigeon got so much notoriety is that it was found in the eastern U.S. where most of the population occurred. And by 1900, people were alive who still remembered passenger pigeons by the billions. So it did come as a shock that something that was so close, you might say, to their landscape, mm-hmm. their personal experience, had disappeared.
And something so abundant to go from billions to none is quite right. The story. More on the passenger pigeon when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Stanley Temple, and we are talking about the passenger pigeon 100 years after it went extinct. You were mentioning that in some ways it served as a catalyst for the entire conservation movement. Can you elaborate on that? It seems sort of ironic that you have to lose a species to start a movement to save them.
Well, at the same time that the passenger pigeon was being pushed to extinction, many other species that were part of the market hunter's quarry were also going extinct or approaching extinction. It included the American bison, wild turkey, any number of waterfowl, cranes. Anything that was marketable was hunted at that time. But it really was the extinction of the passenger pigeon that sort of shocked everyone into the realization that we were responsible for this, and I think the passenger pigeon became the sort of iconic species because it was the eastern U.S. where most of the people at that time lived, people that had experienced passenger pigeon abundance during their lifetime, to suddenly be aware that this seemingly inexhaustible resource had now disappeared. It really was a shock.
By the way, why was it so abundant, like compared to, say, a cardinal or some other bird? Why were there billions to begin with?
Well, it was the food supply. They had this abundant food supply. The eastern deciduous forest, of course, in its original expanse, provided an enormous mm-hmm. amount of mast for them to feed on.
And they didn't have the same predators that some birds,
other birds? Well, they did have predators. That's a good question, Emily. They did have predators, and part of the reason that they were found in such large flocks and such large colonies was a strategy for avoiding predators. The technical term for it is predator swamping. If you can move into an area in great numbers, there are only so many predators in that area, and they can only do so much damage. So if you're a flock of hundreds of millions of passenger pigeons and you settle into an area to nest, there are only so many hawks and owls and foxes and so forth, which means that they can only kill so many of you, and it reduces your individual risk. If you're a pigeon, it reduces your individual risk of predation. But in the East, at least, you know, they were so well known, they were so dramatic, they were such an important resource that when they were gone, it did spark a lot of concern. And we saw almost immediately after the extinction of the bird in the wild, which happened, we were now fairly certain the last bird was 1902. So right about 1900 is when it really sunk in that it was all gone except Martha.
Why wouldn't it sink in when there was like 1,000 left rather than one? Or, you know, why go from billions to nothing without an in-between campaign?
Well, you just asked the question that answers that. Once you reduce them down to very small groups, they were vulnerable to predation and were continued to be vulnerable, of course, to market hunters. The market hunters pursued them right till the bitter end. And indeed, the last few birds in the wild were shot. The last one in Wisconsin was shot in 1899. So the birds were pursued right till the bitter end. But in the aftermath of the recognition, a number of important first baby steps at what we think of as wildlife conservation began. One of the first was a piece of legislation, the Lacey Act, sponsored by Representative John Lacey, a Midwesterner. And his intent in trying to give the federal government the power to regulate interstate commerce was, as he said, to break the back of the market hunter. He figured that if they couldn't transport the birds or the animals that they had taken across state lines, it would make their work much more difficult. National Audubon Society formed as an organization specifically dedicated to the protection of birds. Teddy Roosevelt created the first National Wildlife Refuge to offer places where birds could escape from the more or less continuous hunting that they were exposed to.
It's kind of a, you know, that era, 1910 to 1915 in there, is really fascinating in terms of sort of the change in public thinking and management. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind, of course, is the Boy Scouts in 1910 and this whole emphasis on, in effect, well, we've conquered the outdoors, now let's manage it, let's conserve it. But there was such a, seems to be a change in thinking in terms of the involvement of government in managing things when you get into that end of the first decade of the 20th century. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is kind of the symbol of that, I suppose.
There were a number of really important things that happened right around that period of time. Probably one of the most important with respect to wildlife was a Supreme Court decision in which a private landowner, large private landowner, challenged the state of Connecticut's authority to limit his taking of animals on his private property. And the Supreme Court made a pivotal decision in this case, and they described wildlife as not being your private property, but instead being a public trust. The wildlife belonged to all of us, and the government, state or federal government, had a responsibility to look after the people's wildlife. So it set a legal foundation that you couldn't own them, and it set a precedent that the government was going to be responsible for taking care of our wildlife. And that, of course, those two cornerstones of wildlife conservation in the 20th century have stood us in good stead.
What were the first species to benefit, however sadly, from the extinction of the passenger pigeon?
Aha. Well, you have to imagine that other species that fed on mast would have suddenly enjoyed a much more abundant supply of food. Because yes. if you were a squirrel or a small rodent and the passenger pigeons came through the area, I mean, they literally vacuumed up every acorn and beech nut, so there was nothing to eat. They also, of course, were passenger pigeons were seed predators in that they didn't disperse these seeds. They ground them up in their gizzards so that an acorn or a beech nut that was eaten by a passenger pigeon wasn't going to turn into a tree. So if you think back to what the eastern deciduous forest was like prior to the late 19th century, the dominant tree in the eastern deciduous forest was chestnut.
I knew you were going to say that. Hard to imagine, isn't it?
Chestnuts, they, unlike beech and oak, they don't produce mast. They produce a small annual crop of chestnuts. And those chestnuts are actually a little large for a passenger pigeon to eat. So the dominance of chestnuts and the relatively lower abundance of oaks and beech would have essentially been maintained by passenger pigeons. Eliminate the pigeon from the system. And, of course, many decades after the pigeon went extinct, the chestnut blight wiping out the chestnut, and suddenly you open the eastern deciduous forest up that oaks and beech sort of became the dominant species.
In terms of conservation movement, what were the species, the first species that collectively Americans said, well, it's too late for the passenger pigeon, but we must save?
Yeah, the American bison became the rallying point. We had squirreled away a small herd of them, of all places, at the Bronx Zoo in New York City and had bred them. And bison are pretty easy to breed. So today, almost all of the bison, which are recovering their numbers to the extent that the habitat, remaining habitat, allows them to,
but
they are almost entirely in some way related back to that small herd at the New York Zoological Society. But the other group of birds that benefited were some of the species that we today can once again use as resources. Wild turkeys would have been an endangered species if we'd had the term. Wood ducks would have been an endangered species. Many of the plume-bearing birds that were hunted for their feathers. And all of these species have benefited from the protection that came into place essentially as a knee-jerk reaction to the passenger pigeon's extinction.
Was there ever, at this point, if we're talking about the teens and the 20s, I can put a story to you this way. In 1929, I think, my grandfather had a farm in Iowa and came across a nest of wolf pups. And there was a bounty on them, and he took them in. Mm-hmm. And still considered pests until many years later, wolves?
No, absolutely. Our cultural evolution progressed for some things, and we particularly seem to take offense at people making private profit out of our wildlife.
Uh-huh.
But the idea of defending yourself against depredations or threats from wildlife allowed us to continue to sort of justify why we should be able to kill them with impunity. And we still, of course, have these prejudices against species. I remember a few years ago being asked to testify at a hearing up at the Capitol about the potential listing of the timber rattlesnake as an endangered species
uh-huh.
in the state.
Interesting question.
And rattlesnakes, of course, don't have a particularly good reputation. But a legislator from western Wisconsin's comment was, my gosh, if they're that rare, let's put a bounty on them and finish them off.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's only a few years ago. So, you know, that idea of being able to persecute species that somehow cause us a problem is still with us.
Were there not any sort of at least lone voices crying out about the passenger pigeons and saying this is about to happen? And had there been other birds, you know, kind of like the dodo and auk and so on, that had gone extinct that would have at least made people conscious that extinction was a possibility?
Well, certainly there are other species that went extinct during the 19th century because we overkilled them, because we killed them faster than they could reproduce. But those species, the great auk of the remote islands of the North Atlantic, the Labrador duck that nested in Labrador and unfortunately spent the winter in Long Island Sound, we wiped them out, but they were remote. They weren't known. They weren't mm-hmm. something that people experienced the way they did the passenger pigeon. So the passenger pigeon really was kind of a unique rallying point. But, you know, the amazing thing is that some of the protections that were put in place in the early 20th century did allow some of these terribly depleted species to rebound. So today, you know, we hunt turkeys. They're everywhere, it seems, these days. Wood ducks are abundant. Sandhill cranes are abundant. A lot of these species that were really on the brink did recover, and they are really some of the success stories of 20th century conservation.
What about bald eagles?
Bald eagles, of course, got into trouble much later because of DDT.
Right.
But again, the fact that we responded and did what was required to bring them back speaks to our conservation ethic.
I gather that coyotes were never a concern, at least in terms of their dwindling numbers.
No, I think, you know, there are some species out there that have become almost human commensals in that they do very well in close association with us. And they have thrived, sometimes in spite of our efforts to reduce their numbers.
At Wyalusing State Park, there is a monument to the passenger pigeon, and it has this on it. "We meet here to commemorate the death of a species. This monument symbolizes our sorrow. We grieve because no living man will see again the onrushing phalanx of victorious birds sweeping a path for spring across the March skies, chasing the defeated winter from all the woods and prairies of Wisconsin. Men still live who, in their youth, remember pigeons. Trees still live that, in their youth, were shaken by a living wind. But a few decades hence, only the oldest oaks will remember, and at long last, only the hills will know." That's a pretty poetic monument.
Well, that is not, of course, on the monument itself, but that is from a very famous essay that Aldo Leopold wrote called On a Monument to the Pigeon. And it was an essay that he composed for the dedication of this monument in 1947. And that monument is a very significant, not only in terms of reminding us about the passenger pigeon, something that Aldo Leopold points out, it's easy to forget generations hence, but that was the first monument ever erected to commemorate the extinction of a species.
Right in Wyalusing?
In Wyalusing Park. And that itself was a very important turning point because it meant that our conservation ethic of the 20th century had led us to regret what happened to the passenger pigeon. And Leopold correctly captures the essence of the significance of the monument. It's a beautiful monument. It sits on a bluff right at the confluence of the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers. The site overlooks what would have been a major pigeon flyway, so these millions and millions of pigeons would have flown right past. This year, of course, the passenger pigeon monument's going to get a lot of attention.
Sure.
A lot of people are going to visit and reflect, essentially, on what the story of the passenger pigeon means.
And do you think the reason that it's here in Wisconsin, this first monument to an extinct species, is because of the presence of Aldo Leopold here in the state?
Well, Wisconsin, at least during that period of time when the monument was being envisioned by the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, was a very progressive state in terms of conservation. So it's not surprising that they were sort of a leader in commemorating an extinct species. But the passenger pigeon had been such a conspicuous part of the Wisconsin landscape. The fact that they nested here in such numbers, the fact that at least when they were here, everyone knew about pigeons, led us, I think, as a state to be the first to commemorate them.
So philosophically speaking, and we have the technology, why not bring back the passenger pigeon?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was considered to be pretty much science fiction in the realm of Jurassic Park until fairly recently, when biotechnology has been advancing so rapidly that a number of possibilities have emerged for resurrecting extinct species that have been extinct for a long time. It's pretty easy to resurrect an extinct species if it went extinct very recently and we had properly preserved gametes, sperm, and eggs that could be used for in vitro fertilization, or even if we had properly preserved DNA that
right.
we could do cloning with. So that will happen. But with species like the passenger pigeon, the DNA that we can extract from museum specimens was described by one geneticist as being something like taking the New York City phone book and turning it into confetti. And just for good measure, doing the same thing with the Boston phone book and mixing them up together and saying, here, make some sense out of
it. Mm.
It's a huge task, but the technology is now up to the task of reassembling the confetti, all these little broken pieces of DNA, and being able to reconstruct something that approaches the genome of the passenger pigeon. It wouldn't be perfect. But I mentioned earlier the closest relative is the band-tailed pigeon of the western states. They are closely related genetically, which means they're 99.99% similar. So the idea is if we can reconstruct enough of the passenger pigeon DNA, we can figure out which sections of DNA made the passenger pigeon uniquely different from the band-tailed pigeon. And using genetic engineering, we can simply snip out the sections of band-tailed DNA substitute. Well, what you end up with, of course, is a genetically modified pigeon. It's not a passenger pigeon.
What did you think of the recent New York Times Magazine article? Your quote, you're mentioned in it. In fact, you're called the founder of conservation biology or ecology or something in here. But it's this whole idea of trying to bring back the mammoth, bring back the passenger pigeon. What was it called? Restore and renew?
Revive and restore. Yeah, Revive and Restore. It's a foundation effort led by Stuart Brand, the fellow who created the Whole Earth Catalog back in the 1960s. And he really believes that this is something that we should be doing. And the New York Times article, a lot of the press coverage of this, it's kind of overwhelmingly cool to consider bringing back a mammoth. Imagine having a mammoth or a passenger pigeon. So there's this cool factor that's very hard to deny. But when you step back and really take a good long look at it, you realize these are the types of exercises that often have unintended consequences. And before we start reviving any of these extinct species, we should think very hard about the possible consequences and be very certain that if we're going to bring something back, that we've picked the right species to bring back. So,
what kind of consequence? You mean bringing in viruses that they might be carrying or bringing back something that...
Well, there's a lot of things, of course, that an extinct species sort of left behind. And time passes and ecosystems move on and reassemble themselves. So, for example, as we were mentioning earlier, the eastern deciduous forest is a different place than it was. Even though we've regrown a lot of forest, it's a different forest. What would passenger pigeons do to that forest? Now, of course, we have extensive agriculture. What would the pigeons do to our agricultural crops? And indeed, bringing back something that's been extinct for a long time, you might indeed also be bringing back some viruses and other things that you don't want to have around. Bringing back a mammoth. You think of we're having trouble enough keeping the Asian and African elephants from going extinct. Imagine bringing back a mammoth disease that could spread to our modern elephants.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, you see that even when you're trying to mix moose, bring moose back into Wisconsin and have them coexist with deer, and the deer wipe out the moose every time with that.
That's a complicated undertaking and one that we shouldn't be, entering into glibly. And I think it's good that we're having the dialogue. National Geographic did a cover story of their magazine last year, hosted a large TED Talk conference that brought people from a variety of different disciplines to give their perspective. And I think you found quite a difference that the biotech folks were very enthusiastic about it. The conservationists, the ethicists, the policy wonks, they were a lot more skeptical about the possible consequences of doing this unless we think very carefully about it. And a lot of it does, the cool factor sort of overwhelms our caution, I think, about the possible problems. And one of the proponents of doing de-extinction sort of gave us a shock moment that sort of causes you to think about the ethics of it. He was being interviewed by a science journalist, and one of the sort of standard lines that these biotech folks have is that if we can reconstruct the genome, we can produce an organism. But it's quite a few complex steps between there, but that's their sort of punchline. And the science journalist came back quickly and he said, well, Professor, last year they published the entire genome of the Neanderthal. Does that mean you could bring back the Neanderthal? And this guy stepped right up and he said, absolutely. All we would need is an adventurous woman to be a surrogate mother for a Neanderthal baby.
And
the headline that went viral was Scientist Seeks Adventurous Woman. But bringing back a Neanderthal, suddenly that really hits people that, yes. Oh, there's an ethical dimension to doing that. What would you do with a Neanderthal? And similarly, what would you do with a mammoth? What would you do with a passenger pigeon? It's unlikely that you would ever be able to successfully return them to a completely normal wild existence. So do you keep them in zoos right. as a sort of a curiosity? You know, there are all kinds of dimensions to think about.
Some final thoughts on the lessons of the passenger pigeon extinction when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Stanley Temple, and we're observing the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, that species that was so incredibly prolific in the eastern part of the United States until 1914 when Martha died in a Cincinnati zoo. Well, as we mark this 100th anniversary and moving forward from it, Stan, what do we take home from this experience with the passenger pigeon?
Well, in the quote that Emily read earlier from Aldo Leopold, we recognize that as the centennial approached, that people had literally forgotten the story of the passenger pigeon. It's obscure now. We've had several generations that have not known about the pigeon. So on one hand, we're trying to use the centennial as a way to remind people about the story. And we've set up a group called Project Passenger Pigeon to try to capitalize, you might say, on the centennial as a very teachable moment about human-caused extinction. And obviously telling the passenger pigeon story as a very evocative story is part of that, but there are lessons that we apparently still haven't learned. We are still over-exploiting valuable species and pushing them toward extinction. Rhinos and elephants and some of the most valuable commercial fisheries in the ocean are all being overfished, overkilled.
Siberian tigers.
Siberian tigers. A lot of it is illegal, of course, but nonetheless, we're still pushing them toward extinction the same way we did the passenger pigeon. So we're trying to pull out all the stops, you might say, and get the message out there in as many ways as possible. Many of us are traveling around the country giving talks. There'll be a documentary film on public television later this fall. There are several art museums that are going to feature shows of not only historical artwork of pigeons, but contemporary artwork. There is even a fascinating story that emerged when Emily read the quote from John James Audubon. It turns out on the same riverboat going down the Ohio River, when Audubon saw these endless flights of passenger pigeons darkening the sky, was a European immigrant who was a composer, and he was coming to experience the American wilderness. His name was Anthony Philip Heinrich.
Cabin composer of Kentucky.
The log cabin composer. You know the guy. Yeah, he went on to be a founder of the New York Philharmonic. But with respect to the passenger pigeon centennial, he wrote the first symphony ever composed in the United States.
And he was
inspired by that awesome phenomenon of seeing these passenger pigeons. The first symphony ever written in the United States was dedicated to passenger pigeons.
Ornithological Combat of Kings?
Well, he did that one to condors.
Yes, right.
And that one's better known, but his passenger pigeon symphony has only been performed once in Prague.
In Prague.
In the 1850s. So it is going to be performed here in the U.S. by someone who will do the premiere. I don't know whether we'll have a chance, but the UW Symphony Orchestra here in Madison is going to perform it next November. And they have a good shot, I think, at being the first to perform it.
It just shows you how much a part of American culture this figure, both when it was abundant and when it was extinct, has really become.
Do we have photographs of any of these massive
That is a flying. Fascinating issue. We do not.
Huh.
It turns out that none of the killing, none of the marketing was ever photographed. We have gone through countless photographic archives of the time, and we have just a handful of photographs taken of living pigeons that weren't in captivity during that period. The one that's most notable is of two pigeoners standing there with their stool pigeons in front of them. But no, it wasn't actually ever photographed. And part of that was, you know, the pigeons nested in fairly remote areas and the camera equipment of the day wasn't particularly portable. So it didn't get hauled around and taken into the woods.
With your website, passengerpigeon.org, and with the talks, the documentary, all the different things that are happening with the centenary, if what happens is what you hope would happen, what would the sort of average lay person do? Because I think one of the things that can be frustrating is if you feel, even if you do care about such things, maybe there's not much that you can do.
Right. Well, obviously, today we are in an extinction crisis. Species are going extinct not only because we're overkilling them, but because we're destroying their habitat and polluting the environment. So there are, of course, a few key pieces of policy and legislation that we in the U.S. and many other countries have been directing toward trying to stem the losses. And those are under constant threat. The Endangered Species Act is in itself endangered these days. So supporting the legislation, the policies that are directed toward countering these threats to wild species is incredibly important. And since the problems are not going away and arguably are getting worse, the need for these policies and legislation just grows by the day. For people who want to do something themselves, clearly some of the species that we consume without particularly being aware of the consequences of our consumption are things that we might rethink. Certainly when you look at the crash of some of our popular fish that
we eat, cod
and tuna and swordfish are all being overfished in the open ocean, there's something that people could, by their consumer choices, do that might help these species. But the problem, as we know from the rhino situation, from the ivory situation, is that even when you do your best with policies and laws, if a species has a big price on its head, it will lead to the equivalent of drug trafficking, the illegal trafficking in wildlife. It was heartening that just a couple of weeks ago, 26 nations, including the U.S., entered into an international agreement that for the first time makes the illegal international trade in wildlife a major crime, not just a slap on the wrist to the people that engage in it.
Well, we will see with great interest what happens in terms of the whole conservation and perhaps even the de-extinction of some species. Stan Temple, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.